From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Borders are porous. That's especially true in a world that's increasingly interconnected. That includes the U.S.-Mexico border. Though the pandemic has closed it, and President Trump continues to promise a 2,000-mile wall, goods, people, pollution, as well as dreams and memories still flow back and forth. They always have. They always will. My guest today, D.W. Gibson, has a new book about a 14-mile stretch of the southern border that explores how the landscape and the people who live there are defined by the border, its impermanence and permeability. This hour on Point, the U.S.-Mexico border, what it keeps out and what it can't keep out. With us from Kailua, Hawaii, is D.W. Gibson. His new book is 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall. His previous books include The Edge Becomes the Center and Not Working. And D.W. Gibson, great to have you. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for this lovely book. It was just a pleasure to read it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Anthony.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to this conversation, and I want to begin at the beginning, where you look at President Trump's proposed wall, specifically at a series of 30-foot-tall prototypes for the wall being built on the border. And there are so many absurd ironies about this scene that I want to get into. But tell me about these prototypes and why you chose them as the opening scene in the book.
Right. So I was, looking at the entirety of the nearly 2,000 mile long border between Mexico and U.S. And it was in San Diego County that I felt like we had the most dynamic landscape. You know, you have a big city in San Diego, but you move just 10, 15 miles east of that and you're into the desert. And it's an entirely different landscape, entirely different demographics. So I felt like San Diego County in particular gave me this landscape to look at America in miniature. And of course, the prototypes going up in the Otay Mesa Desert in East County there in San Diego County were just the prime reason for doing this, because that exercise of, as you said, 8 prototypes, each 30 feet high, 30 feet wide, lined up sort of like beauty pageant contestants there in the desert was something to behold. And all that activity around the construction of the prototypes, I felt would be a good epicenter to use for the book.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ironies here is, so here are these prototypes of this wall, of Trump's magnificent, beautiful wall that's going to be built. And it's in a part of the border where they're, am I right? They're actually opening up a new border crossing, right?
Right. I mean, so this is, I think, the prime irony of this exercise of the prototypes. They, in the spot where they built them, they ended up tearing them down in early 2019, rather abruptly. And once they did that, in the exact spot where they built them, they've now started work on a commercial crossing in the Otay Mesa Desert. And I think it's really important, too, to note that it's a commercial crossing. It's going to be designed for 18-wheelers that are moving products back and forth between the American factories in Mexico, the maquiladoras, and the shelves throughout American stores throughout the country. So I think this fact that we sort of went from these 8 prototypes to a crossing really does tap into some of the tension at the border and some of the irony of the border.
Right. Speaking of which, a little more irony. One of the things you do so well is we meet a whole host of characters who are affected by this border, whether they're border control agents, whether they're migrants or people who live on either side of the borders. And we're going to be hearing from some of them directly during this hour. But early in the opening chapter, we meet Aurelia Avila, who watches the prototypes being built from her home just 200 yards away, basically. She lives in Mexico, very close to the border. She can't really understand why Trump wants another wall. Tell us her story and what you learn from her.
So really, she lives even just a few hundred feet. I mean, quite literally in the shadow of these prototypes that were going up. And another important factor in terms of Aurelia and the landscape is that there were already 2 fences between her home and the prototypes. One was made of corrugated metal and then another steel fence. So 2 fences already. So this the prototype sort of represented a third barrier going up. Aurelia was born in Ventura, California, to Mexican parents. Her father was deported when she was quite young. Her mother tried to make a go of it in the States for a while, but just really couldn't make ends meet on her own with a young child. And so they ended up following dad back to Mexico, and that's where Aurelia was raised. And, you know, she's a U.S. citizen. She has her Social Security card. Rather, she has her birth certificate, I should say, but not all of the documentation she needs to prove her citizenship. And so there she is in Mexico and not able to reenter the country where she's a citizen and where she was born.
And it's such a stark contrast because since NAFTA and in the years that followed, you give the sense of this enormous amount of business that is rolling back and forth across the border. With ease, the maquiladoras are set up on the Mexican side. The U.S. is taking advantage of cheap Mexican labor. And so in that sense, the border is very, very porous. But here's a woman who is an American citizen who's living feet from the border, watching a third border wall essentially go up. I mean, it's just such a stark contrast of purpose and effect of this border. I was really struck by that.
It is. And I think that's why it's important to note that that crossing that's being built now is a commercial crossing, because the thing that really stood out to me and came up again and again in all of these conversations I had with so many people is the fact that products move so freely across the border and people don't.
Right.
Maybe more to the point, you know, workers don't, you know. And so I think this goes back to the idea of how interconnected we've capitalistic systems, right? We've entered this phase of globalized capitalism. And I think that works very well for the companies that are producing goods for American consumers. It helps price points at which American consumers purchase things. But it hurts the workers who make all of these items and people who don't actually enjoy free movement as they're supposed to, as sort of capitalism promises they'll have in an open market.
Mm. I want to ask you about the chapter about Friendship Park. I just love this chapter. And for people who don't know, and actually I didn't know much about Friendship Park, this is a park that sits right on the border south of San Diego, where people from both sides of the border used to come together for visits. And you write, quote, "Before the wall, before the secondary fence and the primary fence, there were no barriers along the Mexico-U.S. border." So tell us about Friendship Park, what it was like before it became impossible to just walk across the border. Who went there? Why did they go there? What was it like?
Yeah, so, you know, the border is has been marked several times throughout history, and I know we're going to have Stan Rodriguez on later, and he's going to speak well to this, but after the Mexican-American War was one of the first chances for the U.S. to mark this line, and we've marked it several times since then, and there's been variations in that process along the way, each time only marked by monuments along the way, never really sort of the idea of a fence or a barrier, and that really only started to come into play in small measure in urban areas in the 1970s. And that's when Friendship Park came into existence. And it was really just barbed wire, a couple of posts in the sand. It's on a beautiful bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Pat Nixon was there when they opened Friendship Park, and she lamented the fact that there was a fence at all there, even just the barbed wire. And she stepped over it to go into Mexico to shake hands with people. And over time, it's become more and more built up. And this was, you know, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, San Diego County was where we saw the vast majority of apprehensions at the southern border. So over time, we got one fence at Friendship Park at the bluff overlooking the ocean. We got two fences. And at present, there are actually three different fences at Friendship Park. Mm. And for a few hours every weekend, people are allowed to go past the first two fences to the very first, what they call primary fence, stand there. And it's huge steel bollards with wire mesh between them. You can barely make out sort of the imagery the other side of the fence. But people gather there on Saturdays and Sundays to see loved ones, to say hello. And two ministers put together a bilingual church service on most Sundays. This is a, you know, really important place for people who want to connect with family members on the south side of the border. There are a lot of deported veterans there every weekend. But it's also a place of tension. You know, Border Patrol monitors it very closely. There have been a lot of incidents there that make Border Patrol uncomfortable with the situation. And they've, you know, are constantly sort of pulling back on access to the space, and the people who have organized the park are constantly fighting for more access to the park.
You mentioned the communion service that happens there every week, and you tell the story of John, a Methodist minister, who actually conducts this cross-border communion ceremony with a brother on the Mexican side. Tell me a little bit about him. It was such a lovely story about what he's trying to do there and what he's trying to keep going.
Yeah, so John has been doing this church service for many years now with Guillermo on the south side of the border there. And, you know, he shows up every Sunday. I hiked up to the bluff with him. He's got a backpack with some bread and some grape juice and a Bible, and he unfurls all of this, a microphone connected to a wireless speaker on the south side of the border. And they do this church service, which lasts, you know, just about 20 minutes or so. I think one of the more sort of affecting moments that I experienced while sort of seeing all of this was the fact that, you know, they can't share communion or anything like this. Even you know, the transubstantiated blood of Christ can't pass between the wire mesh. Border Patrol won't allow it. Nothing can pass. Only sort of the music coming from the south. But everyone has moments throughout the ceremony where they stick a pinky up to the wire mesh. It's about all you can really get through those small openings in the wire. And they sort of touch pinky to pinky and sort of try to connect that way. And I think that sort of image and that moment really speaks to several things. One, sort of the human desire to connect at this place, but also the difficulty doing so.
Difficulty that wasn't always there, of course, because it was basically open. And I want to talk about some of the forces, including 9/11 and Operation Gatekeeper and a whole bunch of reasons why the border has sort of closed down over the generations. But just sticking with this Friendship Park, what are Border Control agents actually worried about? I mean, were drugs passing across that? Is that why the wire mesh went up and people can no longer reach out and shake hands and kiss and so on and so forth?
That was what Border Patrol said was the reason for having to put up all of these barriers. Yeah, that's something that John pushes back on, but that's certainly the reason they were giving.
Well, we're talking about D.W. Gibson's new book, 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall. It's a fascinating examination of the U.S.-Mexico border and a really interesting sort of meditation on what it is, what a border is, what it keeps out, what it lets in. What do we lose when we shut borders down? What could we gain if we could figure out a way to open them up again? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and I'm here with D.W. Gibson. His new book, 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall. We're discussing that. It's about his two-year investigation of a 14-mile stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border. D.W., I want to just one more question about Friendship Park, which we were talking about before the break. You talk about how the sort of openness of that park began to really change dramatically after 9/11. You say after the terrorist attack, everything became about national security.
Yeah, and this is a point that John, who runs the church service, really drove home for me because he's been involved with trying to keep this park open for so many years and been living in the area. And I think two major marks sort of defined the idea of the border as a security zone. One was right after NAFTA, we had Operation Gatekeeper, which was after put in place a way for capitalism to sort of still access a globalized workforce, security measures so that workers couldn't cross the border as easily. And then, yeah, after 9/11, when everything gets folded into this new agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and everything is viewed through the lens, everything at the border is viewed through the lens of security and national security. Even though, as John aptly points out in the book, there's really no connection whatsoever, nor has there ever been, between the the southern border and any of the people that were involved in 9/11 or other terrorist acts since then. I think that's one of the places where we really see the idea of xenophobia pop into the picture.
Yeah, in fact, some of those hijackers got into the United States through Canada. There's a really sort of unfortunate irony there that all of the focus on security was focused on the southern border when there was no connection to 9/11. Really, really, really interesting. And DW, you make a great point about Operation Gatekeeper, which you said was launched after NAFTA. And the idea here is to lock down urban crossings, essentially, focus on urban crossings. But what was the effect of efforts like this to slow the passage of people across urban crossings? What happened? They didn't get the effect that they wanted, in other words.
No. So this is where you see, you know, Operation Gatekeeper was really meant to fortify the southern border writ large, but most of the resources went into San Diego County. And so they started putting up the fencing in the heart of downtown Tijuana and San Ysidro there on the north side. And, you know, this is where we see what barriers of the border actually do, because walls, barriers, they never, ever stop traffic. They only divert. So what you see in the 90s, particularly mid, late 90s, once all of this is implemented, you see traffic, foot traffic, people crossing the border, all of that being pushed out to the eastern part of the county where it's more desert, more rural, and much more severe conditions. So this is when we start to see known deaths at the border, those migrants trying to cross, deaths rising significantly. Mm. And again, just known deaths. It's really hard to measure how many people die in this exercise, but those we know, that's when we really start to see those numbers go up.
Yeah, so people are determined. If people are determined to make the crossing, they're going to make it anyway. But because it's so difficult, you point out that then they're less likely to go back and more likely to bring their families. So it has the exact reverse effect.
Exactly. And several people talked about this in the book. You know, it was migratory patterns. You know, people would come for seasonal work. We had the Bracero program back in the 40s and 50s and 60s for agricultural workers, right? So people would come for seasonal work and go back home. It's only when you get Operation Gatekeeper, when you get the sort of post 9/11 world, that you start to see these large Mexican populations grow up in big cities around the country, because people, it was unsafe to keep crossing anymore.
Mm. Well, as promised, DW, we're going to hear from some of the people that you talk to in your book. So I'm going to introduce Serge Dedina. He's the mayor of Imperial Beach, California. He's also the executive director of Wild Coast, a nonprofit focused on conserving wildlife and coastal marine ecosystems, and an author. His latest book is Surfing the Border. And Mayor Serge Dedina, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Great to hear you, Anthony, and talk to you.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to have you. So I loved reading about you in DW's book, but tell me a little bit how the border has changed since you were a kid.
Yeah, you know, I was a kid and, you know, I think of Stranger Things, you know, a bunch of long-haired little surf rats in Imperial Beach, California, the last town on the California coast, actually riding our bikes to Friendship Park, which is Borderfield State Park, and throwing our bikes over, our Schwinn Stingrays, over the cable, and then freely riding around Playas de Tijuana, a beach suburb in Tijuana, right, and buying chicharrones. So there was no border patrol, there was no barrier, there was just a cable or barbed wire that Pat Nixon, as DW talked about, stepped over at one point. That was in the late 70s, and now, of course, if I go down to surf that area, and it's incredibly beautiful. Friendship Park overlooks the Pacific Ocean. You can see dolphins, pods of dolphins surfing in the ocean. It's a national wildlife refuge just to the north. We have the Tijuana estuary where the Tijuana River empties out. And then actually the Coronado Islands just off of Playas de Tijuana are a Mexican national park. So an incredibly physically beautiful area, but now with this giant border, multi-tiered border barrier. So it's a very different place because of that barrier, but still a very beautiful place. But yeah, very, very different changes since I was a kid.
Right. And what do we lose? I mean, what do we lose with that wall going up and the kind of experience you had as you said, a long hair? Did you call yourself a surf rat? what do we lose with that, losing that ability to just step across the border with our Schwinn bikes and move around?
Well, you know, what we've lost on the border barrier is really the discussion of what it takes to have a secure and safe border. And so, ironically, well, we have these giant metal barriers that people are tunneling under just in the Otay Mesa area east of, you know, probably like 10 miles east of the beach in our town extends to the right to the border. And then people are torching their way through it. And more importantly, what's happening is that now people are taking pangas or fiberglass skiffs controlled by the cartels out into the ocean. And you can see those skiffs filled with people arriving in Santa Barbara, Laguna Beach, La Jolla. Some of the wealthiest suburbs or communities on the planet are now receiving the people that are bypassing this giant border barrier. And of course, that's a concern to the Coast Guard and others who are chasing these folks using radars on the coast to track these fiberglass skiffs escaping this massive multi-billion dollar barrier that allows toxic waste and sewage actually to be dumped through it or under it. So that's a big concern of us because we're being hammered by toxic pollution from Tijuana every day. Barrier, as they spent more and more money on the border barrier, they spent less and less attention on this sewage and pollution problem that permeates both the land and water.
I know that this issue around pollution is a big concern of yours. What's the solution to this problem? What are you advocating for?
Well, you know, just so to be clear, Tijuana is a city of 2 million people. And so while the U.S. government over the last 3 years has prioritized massive wall or barrier construction, they've ignored the fact that the sewer system of Tijuana has collapsed. So we've advocated a whole series of infrastructure between Tijuana and Mexico to capture those flows and treat those flows and work proactively with, obviously, the Mexican government to address this. But ironically, the people most impacted by this pollution who've been really sort of neglected here are the U.S. government's own Border Patrol agents and Navy SEALs. The Border Patrol agents who are patrolling this border and getting sick, and the Navy SEALs who have a $1 billion SEAL training base just the north edge of our city. And they're getting sick as well as our residents. So we've advocated for infrastructure to be built, but it's a little hard to have that conversation happen with DHS and for example, in the Navy, when the only priority is to build the border wall. Luckily, through the USMCA process, our congressional delegation negotiated with the White House to get some money appropriated for that. That's taking a long time. In the meantime, they're actually planning on building a $150 million wall through the Tijuana River. Right now, the river channel's open. And I was on a tour with Senator Feinstein, who's actually chief of staff, recently, and we were flabbergasted to learn that this wall would be underway. What they told us, they will be monitoring the weather on the internet, and then when it starts raining, they'll open the floodgates. That didn't seem to be a very science or engineering-driven solution to me, but that's really right now the priority instead of sort of fixing these gaping issues in the border that impact security for all of us.
Well, Serge Dedina, mayor of Imperial Beach, California, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really grateful to have heard from you.
Thank you so much.
And Serge Dedina is someone who shows up in D.W. Gibson's new book, 14 Miles Building the Border Wall. And D.W., just to bring you back into the conversation, you know, listening to Serge Dedina, I mean, one of the things I take away from that brief interview is that the wall sucks up so much energy, so much focus, so much money from other issues that really affect people on both sides of the border, like pollution.
You heard it there. That was one of the reasons I was so excited to have Serge in the book, because he's so good at saying, okay, look, if we're going to make the border all about security, let's think about the idea of security in a more expansive way. It's not just militarizing this area. It's how do the people who live around here feel secure in where they live and where they work? They feel safe in the environment they're swimming and living in. And I think that that's essential. And he also looks at the border not as a place where we divide things, but Serge talks so well in the book about the border as a magnet, is a force that draws people together to solve problems. And I think you see him trying to do that with the Tijuana River estuary and all the pollution. And he mentioned sort of lifting the proposal to lift gates when the weather changes. I walk through that sewage water with Border Patrol agents who pointed out that on sunny days, blue skies overhead, you still have water coming through the gates that are there now. And that just indicates to you it's not always, you know, rainwater, it's sewage water. And a lot of that's coming from the American maquiladoras, the factories in Mexico.
One of the people we hear from in your book is Lance Lenoir. He's a self-proclaimed tunnel rat. That's a Border Patrol agent charged with finding, mapping, and destroying drug smuggling tunnels across the border. You interviewed him for your book, and we have a little bit of tape that we want to play from that. Lenoir says that he's adamant that most of the tunnels aren't sophisticated or any great feats of engineering, but he does find something to admire in them.
If anything is to be admired by our adversary or the result of these tunnels in there is persistence and audacity. Those are the two things I'm constantly amazed of. The fact that somebody can subsist underground in a confined space, this big, that, whatever the case may be, in limited oxygen, because, I mean, let's put it this way, they're ventilating these things with leaf blowers and floor dryers.
Oh, my God. So that's Lance Lenoir, self-proclaimed tunnel rat, a Border Patrol agent who's charged with finding, mapping, and destroying drug smuggling tunnels across the border. DW, what else did you learn from Lenoir and other folks whose job it is to enforce that border?
Yeah, so two things really stand out with Lance. One is, you know, again, he's found tunnels 90 feet deep into the earth. So the footing for most fencing goes at most 6 feet into the earth. So it just shows that the barriers are never going to completely cut off, you know, whatever the U.S. government wants them to cut off. And yeah, this fact about human ingenuity, you know, that people will do what they need to do to get across the border. The thing that really, really, really stood out to me, though, about what Lance said was that if you have a successful tunnel going across this international line, it means you have cooperation on the Mexican side and the U.S. side. It is a binational effort. And I think this gets at the heart of what we as Americans often lose in the discussion, that we bear much of the responsibility for whatever crime is being interdicted at the border. We supply the drug market for the goods that are going across the border, and we supply the firearms, the guns. There's one gun store in Mexico. It's incredibly difficult to buy guns, but it's very easy to buy guns in places like Arizona and Texas and bring them back across the border. And so we need to reckon with the fact that this is these are two things that this country contributes to the issues at the border, and Lance's work really, really gets at the heart of that.
I want to touch down on the other side of the border. Nicole Ramos joins us from Tijuana, Mexico. She's the director of the Border Right Project Al Otro Lado, which works with asylum seekers preparing to present themselves to U.S. authorities. And Nicole Ramos, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I should stress, obviously, Nicole, we learned about you because you are also a character in D.W. Gibson's book. But give us a sense how the pandemic has affected the community where you work, the folks who are hoping to seek asylum.
Well, the border is essentially closed to them. They're not able to present themselves to U.S. authorities to seek asylum. So our work, instead of helping people to present themselves, involves helping people to hide themselves from persecutors that may be pursuing them, shifting legal services to providing humanitarian aid, sanitation stations for shelters, medications, and food. And we're not seeing any clients in the office in order to keep people safe. So all of our staff and volunteers that come from all over the country that would be in Tijuana normally are working with asylum seekers in Tijuana via the telephone.
I see. And is there, while the border is closed and the effort during the pandemic for people to seek asylum is essentially shut down, what does that mean? Is there a bigger and bigger population on the Mexican side of the border of folks waiting to come, hoping to get into the U.S.?
The population continues to grow. People keep trying to enter without inspection because the ports of entry are closed. But border officials repeatedly turn them back in violation of international law, which prevents the return of refugees to a territory where they fear persecution. What is interesting about this is that U.S. citizens can come and leave Mexico without any problem. So they can come for pleasure trips to the beach, to visit the red light district. But asylum seekers who are fleeing for their lives cannot enter.
So that clearly, I was going to ask you what inconsistencies you see regarding who can cross the border and who can't. I guess that would be top of the list.
Absolutely, because the U.S. citizens that are re-entering the United States, they're not being subject to any health screenings. And if the purpose of the border closure is to prevent the entry of persons from a territory where there's high rates of COVID-19, one would think that would extend to some sort of health inspection of U.S. citizens, and yet it doesn't.
Hmm. So what are your hopes regarding the population that you represent in the months ahead? What would you like to see change that would provide some help and essentially allow them to at least get close to an immigration officer and plead their case for asylum?
The U.S. government is one of the most powerful and one of the most wealthiest governments in the world. And it is simply not credible that with all of the expertise that we have, that we cannot figure out a way to safely process refugees who are quite literally fleeing for their lives. So what I would hope is that the border open to allow for the processing of these claims in an orderly fashion, which is completely possible. However, the president and Stephen Miller and others in the administration are making very clear their intent with regard to asylum through this border closure and the new proposed changes to the asylum rule. And that intent is to stop immigration because it threatens their nationalist and white supremacy goals and ideology.
All right. Well, that's Nicole Ramos, director of the Border Rights Project Al Otro Lado in Tijuana. Nicole Ramos, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much for having me.
And D.W. Gibson, stand by. We're discussing D.W.'s new book, 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there
on the top shelf.
That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about some of the challenges facing the country, and as always, we are looking for solutions to those challenges, so we want to know what you are seeing in the city or town where you live. What are your family and friends sharing with you? Tell us your story or leave us your question at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. You can also reach us via Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio, and you can always continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. This hour, we're talking to D.W. Gibson. He's author of 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall, which is the result of a 2-year investigation reporting project that he did along 14 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border. D.W., you know, I wanted to get you to sort of follow up on what we heard from Nicole Ramos before the break, obviously in a sort of an impassioned plea to make it possible for the people that she represents to plead their cases for asylum. What's your view on sort of, you know, immigration reform and what has to happen to make this system work better that has taken up so much oxygen in Washington with very little results over the years?
You know, I think it actually, in an interesting way, mirrors the conversation we're having about policing now. I mean, because if you look at the history of U.S. immigration policy, we essentially went our first 100 years as a nation without any immigration laws. We had laws that pertained to who could be a citizen, but no laws pertaining to who could enter the country until 1875, when we get the Page Act, which keeps Chinese women out of the country. And then a few years after that, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which keeps Chinese workers entirely out of the country. And this was driven by, you know, senators in the West who were feeling threatened by the growth in the population out there. They aligned with senators from the South who were hoping in the future to quell the rights of the recently released people people who had been enslaved. And so you see that, and there's an unbroken line all the way up into the 20th century when we start to get a lot of immigration laws in the 1920s around World War I. A lot of those were fanned by eugenicists. Eugenics, you know, we have to remember, got its start in the U.S., and we sort of exported that out into the world as well. So this idea of maintaining America as a predominantly Western European country is the thing that we've been wrestling with in our immigration policy over the course of our history. And I think that's the thing that we're confronting right now and the issue we're trying to correct. That and the idea of, you know, how capitalism has really just taken over the system. I don't think that we understand quite how much, we haven't reckoned with how much the nation state, our country, has already surrendered to capitalism. I think that we need to sort of confront that and deal with it accordingly in terms of protecting workers.
And by surrendering to capitalism, I mean, in a sense, and this gets to sort of one of the central ironies, which I think we touched on at the beginning of the show, but by surrendering to capitalism, we have essentially surrendered to the idea that borders are somewhat meaningless, right?
Well, this is the thing, right? We speak out both sides of our mouth. So with regard to moving products, yes, meaningless. Let's do it. Let's get this stuff moved around the globe so we can sell it. But in terms of letting people move freely, you know, we try to put up all kinds of barriers. One really quick example that I think really puts this into focus is there's a huge Haitian population in Tijuana and in San Diego as well. They had a massive earthquake, as we all know, in 2010 in Haiti. But those Haitians that arrived in Tijuana, they didn't arrive in 2010. When did they arrive? They arrived over 20,000 of them in 2016. And that's because Brazil had just handed out 43,000 work visas to build the Olympic facilities. And the Haitians flocked there after the earthquake, and they were a lot of them were already migrating, looking for stability in their lives. And so they found refuge in Brazil for a little while so they could do the work that was needed there. Once that work was completed, Brazil didn't renew those visas, and they had to leave and find a new place. So that just shows you how work drives so much of the migration that we see around the world.
Mm. Well, DW, stand by, because I want to go to Stan Rodriguez now, who shows up in your book. Fascinating character. He's a member of the Kumeyaay Nation, and he's the director of Kumeyaay Community College, and he joins us from San Diego. Stan Rodriguez, thanks so much for joining us.
Hoka. Hello, everybody.
It's really good to have you. So just for our listeners who don't know, I want to talk a little bit about the Kumeyaay tribe, whose settlements date back some 12,000 years on both sides of what is now the U.S.-Mexican border. So, Stan, give us a sense of what the border has done to this tribe.
Well, thank you for letting me speak to this. For our people, we say we've been in this area, San Diego, Northern Baja, since time immemorial. We remember when we have village sites that are under the Pacific Ocean right now, just right off the coast. And we have, on the desert side, Imperial County, we have fish sites that were made with stones where there's desert now. So this speaks to how long we've been in this area. Well, when encroachment came, first with the Spanish wave, then with the Mexican wave, then with the American wave, it wreaked havoc upon our people. And once the Mexican-American War was completed, the international border was placed. Well, it went straight through Kumeyaay territory. It cut basically our traditional lands in half. Mm. Now, as was said earlier, The border prior was fairly porous. People would go back and forth. But as the United States wanted more structure, and it seemed like it was due to xenophobia, customs, it became more and more difficult to cross and recross. Now, the problem with that for our people is because for the Kumeyaay people, this land here, Northern Baja, in San Diego County, this is our holy land. In our creation story, it talks about the different mountains, the different places that we go. And there's places where we go to pray. There's places where we go to sing. San Diego has more Kumeyaay reservations, or more reservations, than any other county in the country. There's over 18 reservations here in San Diego. And there's another 6 Kumeyaay reservations in Baja California, Mexico. So to be able to cross and recross is very important for us.
And Stan, that's gotten a lot harder, I imagine. This important this important trip that members of the Kumeyaay Nation make from one side of the border to the other has gotten a lot more difficult, right?
Exactly. Because an example would be when somebody passes away, singers will come and sing all night for that person. Things will be done. We support each other. But then with the border, it makes it more difficult. The Kumeyaays in Baja, it's very difficult for them to come across. They need to get either a laser visa or a pass for like 2 to 5 days so that we can do cultural things. But it's becoming more and more problematic. Another thing that happened too is in Baja, which is in Mexico, they speak Spanish. Spanish is the main language that's spoken. Here in the United States, English is the main language. Now, prior to the waves of encroachment, there were over 50,000 Kumeyaays on both sides of the border. Around 1900, 1901, they were listed as 1,000, less than 1,000. Almost all the Kumeyaay people were gone. We've built up our numbers. We have approximately 4,623 Kumeyaay on both sides of the border. Now, with that said, of that number, there's approximately 41 people who still speak the language. And in order for a language to be vibrant, it needs to be used. It becomes more and more problematic if you have a Kumeyaay on the Mexican side of the border who speaks and he has nobody to speak to, somebody on the United States. It gets difficult for that for the cultural connections to take place.
I see. So another way that the culture is being threatened and is at risk of being erased, essentially. Stan, I want to ask you one last thought, though, and I know this comes up in DW's book, and that is the Kumeyaay people have been around for some 12,000 years. The U.S. border, not nearly as long. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of how that creates a certain perspective that you have on this border?
Sure. You know, for our people, we say even longer than 12,000 years. It's been documented 12,000. We say it goes back even farther. Now, with that said, the border that's been put here, it's making our own people illegal aliens or aliens in our own land. When the Kumeyaay from Baja come across, staying within our Kumeyaay territory, they're basically classified as aliens. And when we go across into Baja, we are, you know, we're aliens too. This is our territory. And to put it in its context, have you ever heard the name Tijuana?
Oh yes,
it's a Kumeyaay word.
That I didn't know.
By the ocean.
Yeah,
it's by the ocean. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of the the beer Tecate?
Yes, I have.
Well, it talks about Tecate Peak, and what Tecate in Kumeyaay means it's an old man who chops wood. Mm. So there's a lot of Kumeyaay woods, and it's on both sides of the border. So it speaks to our cultural roots within the area and the difficulty that we have in keeping our culture alive, our language alive, and our people intact.
Right. Well, Stan Rodriguez, he's a member of the Kumeyaay Nation, and he's director of Kumeyaay Community College. He joined us today from San Diego. Stan Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciated hearing from you. Many
thanks. Thank you for letting me get on.
Yeah, it
Thank
was you. Great. So, DW, I'd love to sort of get more from you on what you heard in Stan's talk. It's very moving, this idea of a culture that's thousands of years old sort of being bisected by this border.
Yeah, and I think it should be humbling for all of us, right? Because we, you know, Americans tend to really think about the border as this this thing that's been around forever, that's so permanent. I mean, that's what a 30-foot barrier is supposed to tell us, right? But Stan, more than anyone I talked to, I think, really changed my perspective on borders or affected it or made my imagination grow, because he really pointed out to me that the border is not static. It's moved so many times over history, even after after the U.S. established it. And I think we need to really hold that in our imaginations and track that point.
In so many ways, your reporting on the wall brings to light sort of the same kind of contradiction again and again and again, that the wall doesn't really respond or reflect the real world or the real challenges. It's a wall that seeks to keep people out when people will always find a way to get through. It's a wall that creates a border when business and technology are essentially borderless. It's a wall that would, you know, go just a few feet into the earth, but we already heard that people know how to tunnel 90 feet down underneath it. So again and again and again, you come up with these wonderful observations about this wall just seems to be completely disconnected from the kind of reality that we're all living in.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's captured in the word wall. I mean, think about it. And this is something that occurred to me several times as I was working on this. I saw so many barriers at the border, but none of them actually resembled a wall, right? And I think that idea of a wall really taps into the mythology we hold as Americans in our mind, again, of sort of our place in the world, our importance in the world, our permanence in the world. And I think, and even our sense of responsibility. I mean, think about it. How do we define what we call the American dream? The American dream, when it gets down to it, is a white picket fence. It's private property, right? And that white picket fence, just like the idea of a border wall, it establishes it our achievement and it establishes our sense of responsibility, right? Our sense of responsibility as Americans has always been focused on ourselves, you know, not necessarily on how we might contribute to a community, but how we might survive in that community on our own terms. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? And so the idea of a fence, a white picket fence, or a wall at the border helps us define that very limited sense of responsibility. And Stan Rodriguez is so good at making us think about responsibility in a more expansive way and an idea of building community and building a civil society.
So, DW, we've got some comments on Facebook from our listeners. Hector Acevedo writes, "The wall does nothing to improve conditions in Mexico or Central America that compel people to risk everything to come here. It's a stupid idea that is a massive waste of money and a great harm to the ecology and wildlife." On the other hand, we have Michael Richards here, who wrote, "We are not an open borders lawless nation. In fact, every time citizens have had the opportunity to vote on any part of the issue, they have voted against amnesty or permanent residency. We want enforcement." So, DW, respond to that concern there are folks out there who say we got to have that wall because otherwise if you have open borders, we just lose control of our country.
Yes, I think it's about creating ways for people to come through legally and in orderly fashion. When you talk to people in law enforcement, particularly Customs and Border Protection, you know, let's not forget that the vast majority of crime that is interdicted at the border is interdicted at ports of entry by customs officers, not by Border Patrol agents. So we need more crossings, in fact, and not commercial crossings, but crossings that are available to citizens to use, to make family visits, to make cultural exchanges, to move about freely. And the more we can organize those crossings and create policies, allow people to move more freely, people will be able to do so legally and in an orderly fashion.
DW, you grew up in San Diego. How did the proximity to the border affect the way you thought about it growing up?
Yeah, you know, I actually grew up just north of San Diego County in Orange County, but it's interesting because I think that the way Southern California works writ large is really largely divorced from the border. I mean, I fixate on one of the freeways in San Diego County called the 8 Freeway, which runs parallel to the border, just about 15 miles north. And I say rather bluntly that I think that 15 miles between the border and the 8 Freeway has really worked as sort of a buffer zone, a U.S.-controlled buffer zone, because the population south of the 8 Freeway is largely Latinx and dynamic and people from all around the world. But north of the freeway, the population becomes much more white, much more affluent, and people live their lives as though they weren't that close to the border. We have a very easy time being agnostic to the border, and I think that the more we can interact with it and interact with people who it affects, the more we'll understand it.
Well, your book helps us do that in a big way. D.W. Gibson, he's author of 14 Miles, Building the Border Wall. D.W., thanks so much. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.